Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Vittorio Agnoletto, spokesperson with the Genoa Social Forum, who discusses the protests and police violence which occurred during the G8 summit meeting in Genoa, Italy. Alex Veach with the Sierra Club, who examines the strengths and weaknesses of the climate accord recently concluded in Bonn, Germany, designed to control the emission of greenhouse gases. And Bill Rankin, founder of Global AIDS Interfaith Alliance, an organization working to reduce the spread of HIV and AIDS in Africa, who addresses the role oppression against women plays in the spread of the disease. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Despite the recent announcement that President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin will soon enter talks addressing the U.S. plan to test and deploy a national missile defense system, the White House stated it may break the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty in just a matter of months. But there is another futuristic weapons program, theater missile defense, that critics say is more destabilizing because it is easier to deploy and has the full support of key Democrats like Senator Joe Biden, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. According to the news magazine In These Times, TMD is quickly moving toward full deployment. Its aim is to protect U.S. troops across the globe from short and long-range missile attack. Under its current design, TMD missiles can be placed on trucks, ships, submarines, and planes. Critics fear that TMD will be used by Pentagon planners to lay the groundwork for full-scale space-based weapons. For example, the airborne laser system developed under TMD is very similar to systems which could be used to destroy satellites and other targets in space. Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space says that TMD is a major threat to international security. He told In These Times that many Democrats think TMD deployment is a way to protect our troops and ships, when it is very much part of the U.S. first strike policy in places like the Pacific Ocean. Former Guatemalan President Efrain Rios Montt, who ran his country's infamous scorched earth policy that wiped out hundreds of Mayan villages in the 1980s, is often called Guatemala's Pinochet. While General Augusto Pinochet faced the possibility of a trial in Chile for massive human rights abuses, today Montt is president of Guatemala's National Congress and head of the powerful Guatemalan Front Party that is run by old military and intelligence officials loyal to him. According to the World Press Review magazine, many observers lament that Montt is a long way from facing a human rights inquiry over his scorched earth policies that led to the deaths of tens of thousands of peasants. Political scientist Edmundo Urrechia explained, "We can't say we're close to prosecuting Rios Montt for his past actions. At least in Guatemala, that is a long way off. Yet even the threat of a criminal investigation has weakened Montt's grip on power. Two legislators from his party recently resigned, complaining of the tight control exerted by the former president. Juan Carlos Gutierrez, one of those who quit, says that he runs a theocratic government, but in this case, God is called Rios Montt." This spring, U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill shocked his European counterparts when he threatened to pull the U.S. out of an initiative put forward by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD. OECD proposed regulations making it more difficult for tax evaders to hide away millions of dollars in offshore bank accounts. In response, Le Monde, the Paris daily newspaper, commented, "After dirty air, dirty money." According to The Nation magazine, O'Neill and the Bush administration were responding to pressure from U.S. banks that make big profits by sending funds from wealthy clients overseas to avoid tax liability. Former congressional investigator Jack Bloom, who recently wrote a report on offshore tax havens for the United Nations, noted that U.S. officials insist on a hands-off approach because, quote, "the hot money from around the world fueled one of the greatest booms in the stock market." But Bloom says the U.S. government loses about $70 billion a year in taxes from wealthy people who send their money abroad. By the late 1990s, European ministers realized that they were also losing lots of money due to tax evasion via the offshore accounts. 2 years ago, the French finance minister proposed to cut off aid to nations that failed to monitor bank accounts and refused to cooperate with international law enforcement agencies. But Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, now co-chairman of Citigroup, showed little interest at the time. As French Finance Minister Dominique Strauss-Kahn explained, they did not want to hear about it as powerful banks all use these offshore accounts. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
An estimated 100,000 demonstrators from around the globe converged on the northern Italian city of Genoa, July 20th through the 22nd, to protest the economic and social policies of the world's most powerful nations. The mostly peaceful demonstrations were held as the G8 leaders gathered for a summit meeting in Genoa, behind barricades and under the protection of thousands of riot police. Trade unionists, environmentalists, church groups, and students called for an overhaul of policies promoted by the G8 that protesters argued damage the environment and enrich the elite while impoverishing the world's poor majority. But the actions of a small group of so-called Black Bloc demonstrators who clashed with police soon resulted in tragedy. 23-year-old Italian Carlo Giuliani was shot dead by a young officer as a militant crowd threw objects at a police vehicle. Later in the weekend, police conducted a brutal raid of two buildings used by protest organizers and independent journalists in Genoa. Dozens of people were severely beaten and arrested, many later hospitalized as the Italian police justified their actions by saying they were searching for hooligans and weapons. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Vittorio Agnoletto, spokesperson with the Genoa Social Forum, a group representing more than 800 international organizations that supported the protest against the G8 summit. He discusses the demonstrations and police violence which occurred in Genoa.
We are a coordination of more than 800 NGO associations, parties, unions, and we are against this globalization, not generally globalization, but this globalization where 8 persons want to decide for everybody, for all the world. We are against a world where 1,300,000,000 of people are living with less than $1 for a day. We are against a world where 1,700,000,000 people are living without clean water. We are against a world where 95 of HIV people cannot use drugs. We are for Kyoto Agreement, and we are for Drop the Debt, and for Tobin Tax. We want an international institute, a democratic international institute, where all the countries are the same representation and can decide together.
Vittorio, could you explain to our listeners the two different events that were the central points for the protest? One was a forum that you helped organize speakers from around the world who addressed a vision quite different from that of the G8 leaders and the actual protests in the street.
Yes, we organized a public forum that was a week to discussion about the great problem of this world, about the fight against the debt to change the world, about the financing problem, and a lot of other arguments. And we organized 3 days with a manifestation. The first day was in solidarity of migrants. The second day was to try to pass a red line. And third day was a big, big manifestation.
Now, maybe you can explain to our listeners what you think caused the violence that resulted in many injuries, including notably the death of 23-year-old Carlo Giuliani, who was shot dead by police.
Yeah. The violence was the result of the strategy of our government, because there were 3,000-4,000 black bloc people, and they organized a lot of violence. It was incredible in which way they were able to arrive in the center of Genoa, and they didn't attack Red Line, but they attack always the city, the shops, and our movement. and the police didn't do anything until they enter in our manifestation. At that point, the police beat our groups. This is a problem. And the police was like agree with the Black Bloc. And in one of these battles, a police shoot to Carlo Giuliani.
Now, in another instance of allegations of police brutality, police attacked a building which housed some of the offices and organizing headquarters for the General Social Forum.
Incredible situation where the police beat a lot of people and destroyed everything without any reason, absolutely.
How many people were injured and arrested in that melee?
62 in that night, and in 3 days, more than 200 people.
What do you think motivated the police violence in that instance, where there certainly wasn't any clear provocation?
It wasn't a decision of the police, but the government. They want to show that in Italy there isn't a pacific opposition, but only a violent group. This was the aim of our government.
Do you have any evidence that police infiltrated the protesters, either the pacifist protesters or the so-called Black Bloc groups?
Yeah, we have a film and a photo where the police was inside Black Bloc.
Let me ask you one thing, Vittorio. As regards to the fallout from the violence that occurred in Genoa, is there repercussions, negative repercussions for the movement as a whole in terms of division and lack of unity?
No, and this situation didn't divide our movement, and we are also together. And this was like a miracle, because in Italy it's very difficult to work together, but this is the first time.
Could you comment on the reaction of the G8 leaders saying that they would make the summits in the future smaller and more remote? That was their solution to the violence as they saw it that occurred in Genoa.
The 8 person will meet in a very, very far place. I think they fear and they must observe that they have no consensus from the people about the decision. Now we will organize in a territorial group, and the next international meeting for us is 10th of November. That is the last day of a FAO meeting about agriculture, and is the first day of a WTO meeting in Qatar, and we organize a big manifestation in Rome.
That was Vittorio Agnoletto, spokesperson with the Genoa Social Forum. Receive updates on worldwide actions condemning police violence in Genoa by visiting the Independent Media Center website at www.indymedia.org. After marathon negotiating sessions that stretched until dawn July 23rd, representatives of 178 nations agreed on enforcement mechanisms to bind signatories of the Kyoto Protocol to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases linked to global warming and climate change. The accord moved forward the work begun in Japan in 1997, endorsed at the time by most of the world's nations. But conspicuously missing from the Bonn Agreement was the United States, which under the Bush administration has rejected Kyoto as fatally flawed. Mr. Bush maintains that mandatory reduction of greenhouse gases would harm the U.S. economy. Although the absence of the U.S., which produces 25% of the gases that cause global warming, greatly reduces the effectiveness of the accord, some diplomats and environmentalists hope that the agreement will increase pressure in Washington to join in the future. The Bonn Agreement calls for 38 industrialized nations to reduce their gas emissions to 5.2% below 1990 levels by 2012, while affording nations credits for protecting forests and investment in new technology. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Alex Veach of the Sierra Club, who examines the strengths and weaknesses of the accord and the effect U.S. rejection will have on reaching Kyoto's goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
About 180 countries around the world agreed to take action on global warming. And obviously, as environmentalists at the Sierra Club, we're very pleased about that. What we're not so pleased about are the deals that were done to get certain countries to sign on to the agreement. You know, the idea of the Kyoto Protocol and now this agreement reached at Bonn is for countries to agree to cut emissions. And What's actually happened is that countries such as the US, such as Canada, Japan, Australia, and Saudi Arabia, the groups that work together and call themselves the Umbrella Group, have managed to negotiate loopholes in the treaty that will allow them to keep on polluting whilst looking like they're taking action on global warming. And of course, this doesn't apply to the US. The US has said it will not ratify the Kyoto Protocol. It did not take part in negotiations in Bonn. So the encouraging thing is that other countries around the world, especially countries like Japan and Canada, who have previously been rather obstructive in these negotiations, have now agreed to start taking steps to curbing global warming. The only problem with these things is the issue of taking credit for what we call carbon sinks. Now, that's a theory that you can avoid cutting your pollution because you have forests in your country, and that means that as forests grow, they soak up a certain amount of carbon dioxide. The countries can then use that as credit to offset emissions from power plants. And so that's kind of troubling, in that what happens is, in theory it sounds like a good idea, but in practice it means that countries, heavily forested countries that also have a lot of industry, can avoid cutting their pollution just simply because they have forests. So it's kind of a tricky issue, but all in all, it's got to be a good thing that we've got this agreement on climate change.
With the U.S. rejection of the Kyoto Protocol, can the nations of the world go forward despite the fact that the U.S. alone produces 25% of all the greenhouse gases? I mean, is this treaty really going to make a difference given one of the major polluters isn't opting in?
Well, I mean, there's two answers to that. I mean, yes, it's still going to make a difference. With the inclusion of Japan and Australia and Canada and Europe, we're going to hit the magic figure, which is 55% of the world's carbon dioxide or global warming pollution. The protocol has a mechanism whereby if enough countries sign up that cover 55% of global warming pollution in the world, the treaty comes into force. And so that's why it was so important to get Canada and Japan to agree to the protocol. The idea is that as other countries start taking action to cut their pollution, companies that work in the U.S. will see that there's a competitive advantage to producing cleaner technology, cleaner cars, cleaner power plants, that kind of thing. And, also with international pressure, as countries start to ratify it, the U.S. should come on board. At least that's the hope. The second point to make is that this doesn't mean that just because the U.S. isn't part of the Kyoto Protocol, there's still several things that we can do to start cutting our global warming pollution here in the U.S. You know, the biggest single step we can take to curb global warming is actually making our cars and SUVs and light trucks go further on a gallon of gas. And there's some exciting developments on that at the moment.
When people take a look at the goals and the timetable of this treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, there are those who say, although this is a grand effort, it may be too little too late. What's your view?
Well, it's never too little too late to do something about global warming. I mean, you know, we hear a kind of a lot of horror stories and, people think the environmentalists are wringing their hands in absolute terror at what's going to happen. I mean, you know, there is a problem. Global warming is going to change our climate. We need to start taking steps. You know, that's kind of the bad news. The good news is that there are actually things that we can do which will mean we can curb our global warming pollution and save ourselves money at the same time. And so things that are good for the environment can also be good for the economy, good for all of us when we come to paying our electricity bills and paying our gasoline bills. So it's not all bad news. And certainly, you know, while it's going to be a tough struggle to reduce carbon dioxide to safe levels, there's no reason why it should be painful to the economy. And clearly, you know, no matter how small we start, no matter how low the goals of the Kyoto Protocol are, you know, the sooner we get on this path, the sooner we get going, the better it's going to be and the easier it's going to be.
Alex, just a final question here. How powerful is public opinion both here in the United States and abroad to exert pressure on governments and industries to accelerate the reduction of greenhouse gases beyond this starting point with the Kyoto Protocols, now with some framework here in Bonn, Germany?
Well, it's the most, it is incredibly influential, and we've seen that the administration has almost changed overnight the way that it presents these issues. You know, the administration was just amazed by how wrong they were about how people received their energy plan. And it was all because local folks all around the country, Sierra Club members, environmentalists, concerned citizens, everyone were voicing their absolute horror that this energy plan paid no attention to energy efficiency and renewable energy. And, you know, the vice president went from talking about conservation as a sign of personal virtue but no basis for a sound energy policy to the situation now where last week he made one speech where he must have mentioned energy efficiency or conservation about 25 times. And so, yeah, I mean, it's so important to keep telling your elected representatives, you know, do the right thing on energy. Let's talk about efficiency. Let's talk about CAFE standards. And let's talk about renewable energy. It's the only way we're going to start making progress on global warming, and it saves us all money at the same time.
That was Alex Veach with the Sierra Club. Contact the Sierra Club by calling area code 202-547-1141 or visit their website at www.sierraclub.org. At the UN summit on AIDS held in June, delegates pointed out that the oppression of women is perhaps the key factor in the spread of the pandemic. Until women have personal and economic power to combat sexual exploitation, experts say progress in containing the spread of HIV and AIDS will be greatly hindered. In sub-Saharan Africa, where 70% of all HIV-positive individuals live and die, women comprise a rising percentage of the total affected. Millions of babies in Africa are born with the disease each year, and care is almost non-existent. In some African countries, the infection rate among teenage women is twice that of males the same age. The Global AIDS Interfaith Alliance, or GAIA, is one organization that is working to reduce the number of women and children exposed to HIV and AIDS. Based in San Francisco, its nurses, physicians, and epidemiologists work through religious and interfaith organizations to promote HIV prevention strategies in developing countries. Its initial focus is sub-Saharan Africa. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with GAIA's founder and president, Bill Rankin, about his organization's work and the challenges posed by cultural and social discrimination against women.
Our whole impetus at the very beginning was to work on the focused problem of preventing vertical transmission of HIV. That means mother-to-infant transmission. And as soon as we recognized that as one of the few really major ways in which HIV gets transmitted, that led immediately to the next thought, which is that if we're trying to save these babies, we ought with the same amount of zeal, be trying to save their mothers as well. And that, in turn, led to, I think, a fairly meticulous examination of the grotesque status of women in so many of those countries. And by the way, when I say that, I don't mean that women are home free in the U.S. or elsewhere either. But the problems that women face are so awful. For instance, the belief widespread that if you are a male and if you are HIV positive, then to, quote, have sex with a virgin would result in your being healed is no help to women. Another factor, of course, is the abysmal economic status of women. They risk, if they ask their husbands, for instance, to use condoms, they risk being beaten and dispossessed. And if they are thrown out of the homes, then sometimes they have no recourse for their survival except to become so-called commercial sex workers. And so the human rights issue buried in that is just obvious. Women have abnormally high rates of infection. At the UN General Assembly special session, for instance, the Prime Minister of Mozambique, where we're going to be working in October, who is himself the former health minister of the country, said, among other things, that the overall infection rate of girls and young women is twice that of boys in the same age range. And that's not atypical of many countries in sub-Saharan Africa. You have the phenomenon of husbands going off to urban centers to find work, and then they frequently become sexually active there with other women, and then they return home, sometimes to die, and they infect the wife. The whole business of sugar daddies, so-called, and sexual activity with increasingly younger girls, women don't stand much of a chance, in my opinion, at least as compared with men, of getting through this HIV pandemic, especially if they live in high-incidence areas.
Well, what is your organization doing specifically to try to address that?
We work on a whole array of prevention strategies, self-care strategies, and orphan care strategies, trying to do that in ways that are culturally sensitive and so forth. And specifically, we do role plays with women on how, for instance, to try to negotiate with their husband concerning a condom, and how to tell a husband if you've been tested and found to be HIV positive. And by the way, of course, that means in the usual case that he has infected you, how to tell him and then proceed from there. So that they're very simple strategies for that we would think of maybe as being somewhat unsophisticated, but they tend to be fairly effective in those cultural situations. So it's a matter of first listening very carefully to the women about what it is like for them, and then trying out different strategies that they think on their terms might be helpful.
That was Bill Rankin of the Global AIDS Interfaith Alliance. The organization may be reached at area code 213-461-7196 or on the web at www.thegaia.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.